So let's get to work. And I am very proud to introduce our first speaker of the day. I was extremely proud to be part of his Westminster campaign last year when he returned with his biggest majority ever. Or should I say his biggest majority yet? We can use many words to characterize this man: honesty, intellect, integrity, vision, determination. But I simply say that he is the SDLP at its very best. So, conference, please give a warm welcome to the MP for Foyle, Mark Durkin.
Thank you very much, Ronan, for that slightly overblown introduction there. Conference, I'm delighted that you have given me that welcome, because basically my task today is simply to welcome you to the city. Obviously, I am hugely proud to serve this city as its Member of Parliament. I'm hugely proud to serve alongside such a strong SDLP team in terms of three MLAs here out of the six MLAs for the Foyle constituency, and alongside a very strong council group, a party that has given such leadership within this city and through its work in the city has shared the party's message of leadership all down the years, because in this city, as in some of the other places in the north where we had strength, we practiced and proved the benefits and merits of power sharing when everybody else discounted it and dismissed it. So through all the hard and difficult days when councils didn't have many powers, when there wasn't a lot in terms of democratic channels to offer people, the SDLP here, as elsewhere, pioneered and proved to be the pathfinders for the sort of ethics that we then put at the heart of the Good Friday Agreement, and again had to persuade and rally other parties too. And of course, just because we have institutions that are modelled on that ethic of power sharing doesn't mean that everything just rolls along on the wheels of inevitability. If you're going to work institutions in that method, and if you're going to use those institutions to try to serve the civic, social, economic, cultural and environmental needs, you need to make sure that you have parties that understand and know how those sort of systems need to be used, how public policy needs to be worked and needs to be developed. And that's why it's so important, not just that we think of the SDLP in terms of our ideas for how institutions and processes should work, but we need to be showing people that we have far better ideas and we have a much stronger push and urge around making society better, making the economy stronger and grow, and doing so in ways that emancipate all of the cultural talent that there is in this community, while fully respecting all of our environmental responsibilities as well. And that's why the conference today is so important, as offering us an opportunity in terms of ideas, not just hearing and reflecting the ideas that we're hearing from within our own membership and from key sectors in society, but also then being able to show and tell that we have those better ideas for better governance here, for better performance. We have now had two terms of assemblies since the restoration of devolution in 2007. And so we have two parties who have been in almost total power since then, because they've been quite happy to exclude the rest of us in terms of budget details. They've been quite happy to exclude the rest of us, even when it comes to so-called cross-party agreements like the Stormont House Agreement. They're quite prepared to do it alone, as, oh, it's just the big two, we'll tell everybody else what's going on. And yet, do we really have a sense of strong devolution? Do we really have a sense that we can tell people in Scotland or people in Wales that we have done more with devolution over the last 9 years than they have done, that we have shown more innovation, that we have shown more creativity? When have you heard anybody, and I certainly haven't in Westminster, heard anybody talk about ideas that have been happening under Sinn Féin and DUP in Northern Ireland that should be replicated or copied elsewhere, that should be taken up in Westminster, should be taken up in Scotland or Wales? You don't. And we are letting ourselves down if we decide that we're going to leave the leadership of our devolution in the hands of Sinn Féin and the DUP. And the only way of providing alternative leadership is by giving a stronger mandate to the SDLP. And we know there is disillusionment out there. We heard it last year in the Westminster election, just how people are disillusioned with what's happening at Stormont. They're even more disillusioned with what hasn't been happening at Stormont. But we need to make sure that people understand that there's nobody more frustrated than us, because we had better ideas, we had better hopes, and we are offering better plans in our manifesto, and that's what this conference today is hopefully going to reflect and going to underpin. But we have to say to people that while we share their frustration, the only answer to that, the only way of putting us in a stronger position to make sure that the next programme for government actually can be more meaningful, more purposeful, and more reliable in terms of any promises that are in it, is by giving a stronger mandate to the SDLP. People can't expect us to be responsible for the failures of other parties if people don't give us a mandate to actually counter and be stronger against other parties where it counts in the Assembly. And I know there is a temptation, particularly after elections in the South and all the rest of it, people saying maybe, well, if you want to send a message to parties that aren't delivering, you do it by voting on a non-party basis or going off to independence. But let's be very clear. While people in the South, for their own reasons, chose to give strong mandates to independents, and those independents very strongly canvassed on the grounds of, well, you know, party politics, what does it do, what does it deliver, create change. What's the message since they've been elected from those independents? It's up to the parties to form government. It's up to the parties to do this. It's up to the parties to do that. So people in the North need to realise that when it comes down to it, when it's after the election, it is going to be down to parties to work out how the executive is going to be formed, what the executive's purpose is going to be in terms of the programme for government under the system of de Hont, which we won't get Alex to explain. The fact is, if people decide to go off and vote independence, they won't be weakening the parties that have failed. They will actually be strengthening the parties that have failed, because the de Hont system will work on a basis that the two biggest parties will be stronger if other parties are weaker and people flake off to independence and other bases. So people need to understand that very clearly, that there is a different dynamic, there is a different gearing within the system that we have in the North. So we need to make sure that people are aware of that, as well as being aware of the very strong and positive and ambitious policy ideas that we will be putting into our manifesto. So we have a job of work to do today. We have a job of work to do in the weeks ahead. So I know we have a busy platform today. We have a very busy and interesting and hopefully productive agenda today. There's also a timetable. And I know that any slippage in the timetable later on in the day will be blamed on me. if I don't do and execute my task briefly from here on in terms of welcoming all of you to the city. I am so proud to welcome this conference here to the city, and in particular, particularly to this hall, which has so many memories for me at various early and not so early stages in my life. I am not one of those who can claim triumphs on the stage here in Fashina or in anything else, and I won't recall my one time to be on the stage here, which, believe it or not, which will come as a surprise to certainly an SDLP audience, but maybe to any audience, which was actually in a mime performance. and I sense there's a wish to see me repeat that very mode. So I will move to that quickly enough, but it is a delight to say to all of you, Fáilte of Galair Gadara, agus Halla Colin Kill. And it is hugely important, and we haven't picked St. Columns Hall just because of its name. Obviously, it has a history and a resonance. There isn't anything obsessive going on around our new leadership or anything else like this, but I hope that people will appreciate the venue, not just as the hall splendor, but it sits here right absolutely in the heart of the city, right on the walls. So for visitors to the city, I'm not encouraging people to avoid or miss any of the sessions of conference today, but there are plenty of attractions and distractions nearby if you need them at any stage to restore your concentration or to cope with all of the wisdom that has been shared in here. So again, to welcome all of you, to appreciate the warmth of your presence here in the city, and to encourage everyone to participate very positively in this conference, which is about proving our own sense of renewal to ourselves, which is about making sure that we get in stride for the challenges of the Assembly election, and to make sure then that we continue that positive stride into the next big electoral challenge after the Assembly election, which is going to be the EU referendum. And that whole commitment of the European ideal of people being better together than apart, of giving priority and purpose to economic and social and environmental responsibilities, that is core to the absolute DNA of the SDLP. And we will see all of those themes resonating throughout today and into the address from our leader this evening as well. So we have a lot to look forward to, and you have had enough from me, and I'll go back to miming.
Speaking of the Dahan mechanism, I hope I get this right, but I remember having a pint with Mark one night, and he told a story about during the talks for the Good Friday Agreement, when Dahan was all the rage, and Tony Blair apparently asked Seamus Mallon, would you, Seamus, please explain to me what is the Dahan mechanism? And Seamus pointed at Sean Farran and Mark, and he said, talk to these two. One of them can explain it, but doesn't understand it, and the other one understands it, but can't explain it. On with our first session, which is entitled Tackling Crime and Building Safe Communities. And I'm delighted to invite to the stage to introduce this session one of our newest MLAs from West Tyrone, Daniel McCrossan.
Thank you, Ronan, for the introduction, and thank you to Mark for his opening address. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to take this opportunity to welcome you all to this year's SDLP annual conference. As introduced, I'm the newest MLA to the party, and I represent West Tyrone. This year's annual conference is a bit different from our usual fare, but I think we can all agree that the best change usually happens in the spring. Today's first panel will explore how we in Northern Ireland tackle crime in our communities, how we support victims of crime, and how we understand those who commit crime. On my right, when I welcome to the stage, we will have four people who have spent their lives trying to deliver these better outcomes for the North. Our panelists today include, and can I ask you to give a very warm welcome to Assistant Chief Constable Will Kerr, WillCare has 25 years policing experience in a range of operational roles across Northern Ireland, most recently as Assistant Chief Constable with strategic responsibility for policing in the Greater Belfast area. You're very welcome here, Will. I'd also like to welcome Alwyn Liner, Chief Executive of NIACRO. Alwyn has over 30 years of experience in the voluntary sector and has led NIACRO as its Chief Executive since 2001. Could you give a warm welcome for Geraldine Hanna, Chief Executive of Victim Support NI. Geraldine. Geraldine has over 15 years of experience in the victim sector and has a crucial force in establishing a witness service for courts across Northern Ireland. And I'd also like to welcome a very familiar face to the panel, the SDLP's North Belfast candidate, Nicola Mallon. During her time in office, Councillor Nicola Mallon has been a compassionate advocate for everyone in Belfast, as shown during her successful and vibrant time as Lord Mayor of Belfast. As a councillor representing Old Park DA on Belfast City Council, she's continued to promote the need for jobs, housing and equality for all, and will continue to do so when elected as the new North Belfast MLA. And finally, allow me to introduce our facilitator on this important debate and our keynote speaker, the SDLP Spokesperson for Justice and MLA for West Belfast, Alex Atwood.
So are these the mics live now? Yes. So a very big welcome to all four panellists. And I was speaking to Will earlier, and I said that I thought it was very important that we started, if you like, where Will left off yesterday, when Will briefed the media and, more importantly, spoke to the people of Northern Ireland about the threat that exists at the moment. And I was saying to Will, and say to him again now, that that was a very forthright briefing that he gave to everybody yesterday. So I want to start there, if I could, Will, and just again indicate where the police see the current situation, because you did put it in very stark, in a very stark way.
Yes, you're right, I did, and we thought it was very important. I'd had a conversation with George in advance, George Hamilton. We thought it was very important that we were just as honest and transparent as we could be about the scale and the threat. And we're always trying to keep it a real sense of perspective around the threat as well. This is not 20 or 30 years ago. It won't go back to that. We're absolutely certain of that. But we have a couple of hundred very active dissident Republicans at the moment who are trying to take Northern Ireland back to the past. I described them as playground bullies. I wasn't trying to be flippant when I described them as that. It's just, it seemed the best analogy to me. Everybody else has moved on. You know, we're trying to develop our economy. There's a sense of growing maturity and confidence in the North, and we have a group of people who just don't understand their own history, and they're trying to use the excuse of 2016 and the commemorative events for violence, where there's no justification for that violence in our history at all. So we wanted to go out and start the debate about if we're really going to deliver the ambitions of a Fresh Start agreement, if we're really going to get rid of parliament or paramilitary organisations on both sides of the divide. And loyalist paramilitaries cause every bit as much harm. They're extorting, intimidating their own communities. They're involved in providing drugs and selling drugs within their own communities. And we need to remember there's harm being caused on both sides here. We need to be honest about the scale of the threat, and we need to be honest about what we need to do. And that passive community support that still exists in both communities for the activities of these groups, if we're really going to reframe the conversation and make sure the next generation and my 11-year-old doesn't have to experience that in the future.
Well, Nicola, you're a recent mother. Mm-hmm. So how old is the child now?
7 months.
7 months. So Will has someone as a child 11, you have 7 months. You represent Ardoyne, and around Ardoyne there has been dissident activity. What was your response to what Will and the police said yesterday?
I think it was useful to have an open analysis, and I think it's very important that we are aware of the level of threat and we know everything about it and the context and the perspective. But I believe that if we are to get to grips and tackle this, then the community cannot be lost in it. The community, without doubt, is the strongest ally that the police will ever have and ever needs. And my concern, coming from a community that, you know, has seen advancements in policing, but also struggles with issues like follow-up and response times, you need to be able to engage, you need to be there, you need to build trust, because historically it hasn't been there. And I'm just concerned that that can get lost in the scheme of things, and I think it's really, really important, Will, that that is not lost.
Alban, like, you work with the prison community in many circumstances, and I don't want you to make any comments, obviously, about the politics around all of this, but the number of people in prison at the moment and the number of young people in prison at the moment in relation to dissident activity, it's more than we think.
It is more than we think, and the ways in which we are currently holding folks who are in for those offences also puts great pressure on the prison system in their separated conditions. And while those prisoners aren't happy with the conditions that they have, the fact that they have different conditions puts a huge strain on a prison system, which we are all keen that we're able to reform. And so events of a week or so ago put pressure on the staff who are already concerned for their safety, staff in the prison service, but also staff in all of the NGO and private sector organisations who bring services into the prisons, and there are concerns there. Now, obviously, we all know that there's a level of threat and concern around that, but we're there, as our prison staff there, to try, in fact, to make people's lives better when they come out. And so it's very important in terms of, you know, we talk about the community support for our work, that people understand that people are doing that at some concern to themselves. Their families are concerned about it. Certainly staff express that concern to me. So for all of our concerns, for Nicola's 7-month-old, for your 11-year-old, for all of for our families, it's important that we have the stability we want.
Well, your points are very valid, not least because of the terrible incident in Belfast a short while ago with the attempted murder of a prison officer with his wife. A matter of seconds earlier, being close by, and the party would again send our sympathy and support to him, to his family, and to all those who are in front line and under threat at the moment. But at the far side of all of this, unfortunately, there's a lot of victims. There has been over the years, and there continues to be victims, Geraldine. What sense do you have at the moment of the level of threat, and is that actually working itself through and re-traumatising victims?
Well, I think for a long time in Northern Ireland there's nearly two types of criminals. There's your normal everyday criminal, and then we have our criminal that is associated with the legacy of the conflict. And as such, the victims can often fall into those two categories as well. Where we are facing sort of dissident threats and issues with legacies of the conflict and paramilitarism working within communities, we have, in some senses, a forgotten victims, and victims where the criminal justice system is struggling to be able to meet. So an example would be, someone spoke to me this week, a man, and he told me, he came to me for advice, and really what he was saying was he had, his son had been attacked last year when he'd been out in the night out. He intervened in a fight. One of his friends was assaulted, and he intervened. And he was assaulted. He made a statement to the police, and a couple of months ago, or had heard nothing since, but then about a month ago, someone came to his father's workplace and told them to tell his son to withdraw his statement. So his son withdrew the statement. Now, that man's question to me was, what else could he have done? And to be fair, I didn't know what else he could have done. Because whilst the criminal justice system and the criminal justice organisations can offer special measures, and we try to put forward measures to prevent intimidation, ultimately, when someone is faced with that level of threat against their family, against their children, their family members, the desire for justice sometimes takes second place to the desire for security. And that's an issue that we're facing. And it's until we take a step forward and appropriately address the issues that are facing our local communities, we have a section of victims in Northern Ireland who are being let down.
Yeah. Like, well, you'll have a lot of experience of the threats to witnesses and interference with witnesses in due process.
Oh, absolutely, very much so. And I think the point's very well made. And it's one of those things that would be very easy to give a trite answer to it and say, well, of course they should make a statement. Of course they should be willing to give evidence. They should bypass their concerns for the families. The needs of the criminal justice system are more important. But that's not the case. And human dynamics won't allow that to happen. I think the answer to the question in part, I was very struck by Nicola's challenge. And I think it's a very valid one as well. And the problem in Northern Ireland for us at the moment, and I'll be very honest and blunt about this in terms of the policing challenge, is that that threat of hidden harm, the threat posed by dissident groups, the threat posed by loyalist paramilitaries, by online exploitation, by organised crime gangs who operate from the Ivory Coast, from Eastern Europe, we're having to pull a lot more resources into the centre to deal with those high harm, high demand areas of risk for communities right across Northern Ireland and every single community. And it means taking resources from that sort of visible front-facing engagement and relationship they have with communities. And we're struggling with that at the minute, but just trying to calibrate that and get that relationship right, because we know that the sort of high harm, high risk areas are areas that are largely hidden from public view. They don't get to see. We don't like to talk about it too frequently because it's not particularly reassuring for the public when we do. But at the same time, every resource we pull into my world, and I have about 2,400 detectives and staff who work in murder investigation teams, they work in the cyber centre, they work in people trafficking, they work in areas which are deeply important to us with really, really vulnerable victims that we are care desperately to protect and look after, but we're pulling a resource from the street to do that. And we're, like the rest of the public service, there's a finite resource, it can only go so far, and we need public support and engagement and discussion around these really important issues about how we get that balance right. But I'm not going to pretend it isn't difficult, because it is.
Just to move track a wee bit, one of the points of unanimity among the parties in the Assembly, and I'm sure they'll all be promoting this in their manifestos, is to develop this concept and practice of problem-solving courts. That the courts are not about punishment per se, they should be about problem-solving. Alwyn, like, I'm sure your organisation is probably the strongest advocate of that approach.
Well, absolutely, and that would be the way forward.
We would see.
Well, if I could give you an example of something in practice that we're doing at the moment, and then I'll talk about the courts. For the last year, we have been working in a partnership with Probation Board. In fact, it's brought us all into quite close connection with yourselves, with your teams out on the ground. And what we have been working with is making an offer to everyone who is in their last 4 weeks of a prison sentence and who's also coming out with probation supervision, and asking those individuals if they would be prepared, would they want support from an organisation like us for the 12 weeks that follow their release. And the reason for this is that actually those folk who are coming out on licence to probation and who would be of interest to your colleagues are really very likely to go back in again. I mean, that is the traffic. It's not plenty of new people who are going into prison all the time. It's very many of the same people who are going round and round in a circle. And what we have found in the 9 months we've been running this programme is that we have had a significant fall. The number of people going back into prison has fallen by 2/3. Now, I think that's really significant. And it takes you back to why and what have we been doing. And why and what have we been doing is a bit like the problem-solving court. We've been saying to people, do you have somewhere to go when you leave prison? Now, most prisoners will tell you they do. They're going to go and stay with their mother or their granny or their whoever. But actually, mother doesn't necessarily know they're going. And when they get there, they're not necessarily welcome. So we have to test whether there's something real for them to go to. We have to sort out their benefits. Probably most significantly for these folks, we have to sort out their medications, because that is a big issue. And, you know, you'll have heard, as we all have, of the street deaths recently. And most significantly in those situations, they have been people for whom mental ill health has been an issue. So the problem-solving courts will be something back some time before the prison sentence that will be saying, what are some of the things that have got you to the place? We're not excusing what you've done. We'll still have to have some process to make you account for that. But are the issues embedded in mental ill health, in poor family support or broken relationships, often ones you've broken yourself, and are there issues there that can be addressed? And the interesting fact is, most people, I'm always surprised by this, most people, when made the offer, will say yes. Now, they don't say yes on day one, but about 2 weeks before they're coming out of prison, they come back and say, is it still possible for me to have that offer of help? Just what we're saying, the human response to things. So you have to make sure the offer is still open. So the problem-solving court would be very like that in approach, be very practical, and it would look at those issues. But it wouldn't be about excusing behaviour. It would be about saying, actually, if we're going to change behaviour, we have to have some way of engaging on things that really matter to you.
Like you and I represent areas where the end of the journey of somebody who's got into trouble is a consequence of multiple problems before they end up before the magistrate. Is that your sense of things up in Ardoyne and in other areas?
I think that if you're a person who takes an interest in watching people in society, you will know that the sad, sad injustice and reality is that you can take some children, and because of their conditions and their environment, you can write down their fate in a sealed envelope and put it in a safe, and you could be possibly right. And I welcome this approach, this problem-solving approach, but really we need to be intervening much earlier on, and that will prevent us having people getting to a point of a crisis, whether it's through homelessness on the street or whether it's a young offender in Hyde Bank or whether it's somebody that finds himself in prison. One thing that we are not good at in government and society is getting intervention and support early on, whether it's in our healthcare system or anywhere else. So certainly the earlier you intervene, Alex, the better. And the evidence, the overwhelming evidence is there to prove that.
Yeah, Geraldine, I'll come to Will in a second, but I know the police think that in particular the issue of mental health issues for people in about to go into or within the criminal justice system is very critical. The recent Criminal Justice Inspector report in relation to McGabbery advertised the fact that there wasn't in place sufficient support for those with mental health issues. Is that your observation as well?
It certainly would be our experience as well, and over the last decade we have seen an increased number of victims coming forward where there's mental health issues. Those mental health issues can be further exacerbated by the actual experience of the crime itself, but quite often people are coming with those issues and then their mental health is further impacted by the experience of the crime. Certainly when we look at the research on the offender side, it's prevalent there as well, and Northern Ireland in particular has a very big issue in that regard.
It is a very strong sense that the next mandate, on the criminal justice side, the issue of problem-solving courts and the management of the prisons and the character of prisons is actually going to be a big part of the criminal justice narrative. But you will very much strongly believe this issue about mental health has to be comprehensively tackled, otherwise people will just end up before the courts and end up in the criminal justice system?
About 70-80% of people who would be in Musgrave Custody Suite, which is our biggest custody suite in the PSNI, and about 70-80% of the people we would have in there on a Friday night would either have some dependency issues or mental health issues, and that's a real problem for us societally, and we don't understand it, we're not doing enough to fix it. They don't need punishment at that stage, they need help and support, and they're not getting it because the system isn't joined up enough to give it to them. And there's a wonderful experience in Scotland that we keep referring to because it worked very well when they were trying to get a really massively, worryingly high level of street and domestic violence down in Glasgow City. And the seminal point for that work and its success and effectiveness was when they stopped treating it as a criminal justice problem and they started treating it as a public health problem, and they got the health and social care agencies involved in it and they started earlier. And the problem is that approach takes half a generation sometimes, and it's not politically expedient to do it that way, if you don't mind me saying either, because people like results in a 2 to 3 year, possibly a 4 year cycle at the most, and this takes 10, 12 years. And as Nicola points out, my sister's a primary school teacher, and she can tell you the five-year-olds who will have problems, who witness domestic abuse at home, who will follow that same cycle in 17, 18 years' time. And we're repeating the same cycle again and again, but we are our departmental structure is not designed to encourage cross-system working, and we need to fix that very quickly.
Yeah. Certainly in my constituency, more and more principals are saying that the numbers going into primary school at primary one, 4 and 5 year olds, presenting with multiple difficulties is increasing and acutely increasing, not declining, but acutely increasing. Yeah. And as you point out, Nicola, that will track them through their lives. Could I move on to another issue? There was a very powerful conference this week in Belfast, organised by the Victims Commissioner, and it brought together a lot of victims, including, I think, something that you referred to, Geraldine, victims who were very private and weren't involved in any organisations. I'll ask you first, Will, in terms of the legacy issue and the legacy issues, is there a danger that there's a lot of talk about what the structures might be and not enough talk about what the outcomes for victims might be? Because ultimately, yeah, legacy structures have to be about primarily addressing the needs of victims.
Yes, I think it is, and I think that's a fair comment. The challenge for us, though, is that the longer it takes us to fix the structures, the less likely victims are going to have an outcome that gives them any satisfaction at all, whether a justice outcome, whether it's a truth and recovery outcome. We just can't seem to be able to fix the structures. I mean, George Hamilton's made it very clear. Our perspective as an organisation is very clear. The past is poisoning our ability to police the present. It's poisoning our relationship with some communities. We would much rather see it institutionally moved away from policing so we can concentrate on keeping people safe today. And as George has quoted, and we would much rather hand the keys to the vault in its entirety over and let somebody else manage it independently, objectively, away from policing, and let us concentrate on the challenge of policing communities today.
It was a very powerful point made by the Victims Commissioner, Geraldine, that victims generally feel very let down, and let down by the political side, the inability to get over the line structures that will deliver more than what we have at the moment. Is that your sense of where victims are?
Yes, yeah, so definitely echo the comments made by Judith Thompson in that regard. Victims seem to continually fall foul to the political manoeuvrings and agreement to be reached in terms of how we deal with our past. However, the reason why we're trying to deal with our past is to make things better for the future. But without addressing the desired outcomes for victims, we're continually re-victimising them and putting them through further trauma and harm because of a lack of progress, really, and political leadership, I would say, in that regard.
Yes, Alwyn.
Maybe just add on to how the past poisons the moment and the future. I mean, our instances of hate crime, the issues that are going on for incoming communities, because we've never really completed on the how we deal with our own differences and our past differences, means that we are having an ever-increasing number, and we're involved in a service to people who feel themselves under threat in the community, haven't been housed here because they're coming in to be quite often workers in the health professions, and are feeling themselves extremely intimidated and very unwelcome in the community. So it's not just poisoning your capacity to police, but it's poisoning our capacity as a community to move on, to integrate, to engage, and it has, you know, very many tentacles that are still very poisonous.
Given the concentration of what happened in North Belfast, like within the areas around Ardoyne and Ligonier and Old Park, that was the area most affected in terms of the scale of death and injury compared to any other square miles. Do you think that still hangs over the area, and that if the legacy is dealt with in a comprehensive way, Nicola, that people will actually feel, well, we can now move forward more fully?
I mean, with the best will in the world, Ardoyne, and I'm extremely proud to be from it, and there are so many good people, but it's a place of immense pain and hurt. And it's actually so intense, it's difficult for me to articulate. Colm Eastwood and I were knocking doors in Ardoyne just last week, and we went to a door, and this is how it seeps into and poisons every aspect. So I'm a new representative coming forward, very much focused
on the future. And a gentleman said that he wouldn't be voting for me, he wouldn't be voting for anyone, because his father had been killed, and still to this day, his family was denied the truth, and his mother went to his dear grave never knowing what happened to him. And that is the impact. Because of that, he finds it difficult to engage with me while recognising that I've done work in the area. And when you're canvassing in Ardoyne, when you're asking people what are the issues, time and again, people at their doorstep will tell you a story of pain and loss and hurt and anger and frustration. And then, unfortunately, there are people there who want to capitalise on that anger and that hurt and frustration. And regrettably, there are incidences when there's an antisocial behaviour or an attack in a home and a person phones the police. And because of the issues that you've articulated, the police don't come within an hour or 2 hours. And so that person then says to me, well, Nicola, what is the point in contacting the police? And so what you find in areas like Ardoyne is you have a myriad of the complex problems that exist right across the north, concentrated in one area where you have a group of people who feel let down by everyone. And until we get to grips with that, we're never going to be able to move forward. The people of Ardoyne won't be able to move forward, and Northern Ireland won't be able to move forward either.
Can I ask you, Will, Nicola was articulating the sense of people and the pain in Ardoyne. You know, I and other people within our organisation have met widows, RUC widows, before. Mm-hmm. Can you give some sense of the sense of pain within the police family?
Absolutely.
Because of what was tragically and traumatically visited upon so many police families?
Yes, of course I can. You're right, there's a very extensive police family, and particularly a retired police family in Northern Ireland at the moment, not least because of the scale of policing here and the size of the police service in the past, but you're right, there were over 300 police officers killed, there were a significant number of thousand who were injured, and there's a range of police families and retired officers who still feel that pain on a daily basis. I've been a police officer for nearly 27 years now, and I'm proud of that service through those 27 years, both through the RUC and into the PSNI. I think each organisation has brought a different thing to safety and community in Northern Ireland, but I'm proud of all of those 27 years, and I think policing provides, at least to some extent, not a perfect extent, but at least to some extent, a social cement in the North that actually has been undervalued and understated for quite a long time. Of course, I would say that, and I understand that. I'm biased about my organisation and the value I hope it adds to safety and peace and reconciliation in Northern Ireland, but there are a multitude of different families and institutions who feel hurt. We're no different to anybody else. But there is a sense, and we need to be honest enough, just the same way we made honest comments about the threat yesterday, we need to be honest enough to accept that there is a sense in the policing family and some of those families connected with institutions that would be seen as state institutions who feel that the past and the concentration in the past is very much about state institutions and the role and involvement of state institutions and the paperwork and the records that they kept, as opposed to the UVF or the IRA or any other of the organisations who are out actively intimidating or murdering people. And I think that's a viewpoint we shouldn't ignore. I think it's unhealthy to ignore it. We should explore that and ventilate it and at least have a discussion about it.
And I think you're absolutely right that it should be ventilated and discussion about it. I can give this reassurance that, as colleagues in the hall will confirm, in any and all of the legacy negotiations, we are not one-dimensional as a party in terms of it's all about the state. We asked questions of the state, and we'll ask the same and harder questions, if necessary, of those who may have the capacity to answer or not, as they might put it, on behalf of the organisations of terror in the past. I'm very conscious that I've asked a lot of questions, and I know that this big hall with this big audience will want to ask questions as well. So there's two roving mics, Catherine, who keeps us all right on these occasions. So if you can identify, Gerard can start, and then we'll start spreading the mics around.
Hi, I'm a member in West Belfast. I'd just like to ask the panel if they could describe the size and the extent of the problem of individuals and organisations that were primarily connected with legacy issues, but are now also involved in criminal activities today, and probably more for yourself, Assistant Chief Constable.
Well, I think that's for you, Will, first and foremost, and then maybe Alwyn.
The size and extent, it's relatively... I could give you a reasonably binary answer to that. Loyalist paramilitary groups are just organised crime groups at the moment, just act under flag of convenience. Some still, you know, UVF, UDA, no longer the federal institutions they were in the past, but they're crime groups. That's what they do. They extort their own community, intimidate their own communities, and provide drugs in their own communities. On the Republican side of the House, it's a wee bit more complex, as probably the Dublin shooting indicated a couple of weeks ago, because and I appreciate sometimes the public and to an extent politics and policing likes to be able to be definitive about which group with which membership was responsible for which crime at any given time, and it's no longer that straightforward, because on the island of Ireland you have a series of relationships that go back. Some are familial, some are based on who was in prison together, some are based on criminal networks that expand a whole range of different groups. And that sort of nexus between organised crime on the island of Ireland, north and south, and paramilitary organisations, including some of the DR groups and some of the loyalist groups, it's a very flexible, a very fluid nexus between those two groups. So it becomes very difficult to actually point your finger at any given time and say, that group definitely responsible, albeit some make it easier by claiming attacks, particularly attacks on the state afterwards. So that there are lots of groups still involved in criminal activity, but the nature of crime in Northern Ireland has changed fundamentally over the last number of years as well. The borders, George Hamilton and I made this very clear to the Northern Ireland Affairs Select Committee. We gave evidence to it at the beginning of last week that the borders were becoming less relevant generally in terms of policing, because we have organised crime gangs in Eastern Europe or on the Ivory Coast who are extorting money from 70-year-old men living in Derry, or trying to exploit the vulnerabilities of a 14-year-old girl living in Ballymena, and they could do it remotely, and they could do it internationally. And actually, you don't have to be here present, physically present, to cause harm and risk in this community anymore. You know, people trafficking, cyber vulnerabilities, those are the areas that policing is really going to have to start concentrating on now, because they are causing massive harm to very, very vulnerable people. And but the challenge, and I go back to Nicola's point, is the more we concentrate in those hidden areas of high harm, high risk crime, the less we're visible out in the community, having a conversation with you so that you can build a relationship, hopefully based on trust, with your local police officer.
Anyone who listens to the analysis from the Garda in relation to the fluid nature of organisations, especially in respect of what's happened over the last 2 weeks or 3 weeks in Dublin, it's very clear that there's a lot of crisscrossing going on. And so who's next then? Where are we?
I'm Michael Bridge.
Do you want to stand up and ask, maybe?
Yep.
Thank you.
I'm Michael Bridge here. I'll be addressing the PSNI officer. It's about legacy, much like the Ardoyne people. I was involved in the Bloody Sunday incident, right? I had a chat with the Chief Constable at one time, which was contentious discussions. It was on the water side. Never got an answer up. This proposal was, at the time, the HIU that Jesus is currently talking about, was they put the Bloody Sunday investigation under the HIU, which I think is atrocious. And 6 years down the line, after we went to a judicial inquiry, I repeat, a judicial inquiry, found that there was criminal acts committed, and the PSNI, they've arrested one man. We don't know what the outcome was. We know what the outcome is in relation to what's happening now in England, which is for the convenience of the soldiers. But bypassing all that. Then that's exactly where I'm bypassing all that. Is it the PSNI's intention to this day to try to pass it to the HIU and delegate responsibility away from their organisation?
Okay. And that's a very fair question of us as well. The answer is no, we're certainly not looking to delegate or displace responsibility for this very large, very complex investigation. We are absolutely not. I can give you that assurance.
Stop it. Stop you.
Yes, of course.
Well, that is not the Justice Minister, the Justice Office opinion, because they come out quite clearly and stated that it was going to go to the HIU, which doesn't even exist yet, when it's established.
And they
could not possibly do that without a conference, without a discussion with the Chief Constable.
So
that couldn't happen.
Will can answer for the police. I don't think he can answer for the Justice Minister or the Justice Department.
Yeah.
But from a strictly police point of view, your intentions are?
We reflect political intent on what the legislative base is. We have to. We're the police. We have to follow the law. You would expect me to say that. All the assurance I hope I can at least in part give you is that we know how important this investigation is. We are taking it very seriously. We have a team working on it. We are interviewing soldiers. We have made arrests where that's appropriate. We are taking our time to work methodically through what is a protracted and complex investigation. And that's the assurance I was trying to give you about we're not trying to delegate or displace any of our responsibilities at all. I give you that assurance. We genuinely aren't. As to whether the case moves to the HIU, that's a matter for legislators. If they decide that all the cases move across,
It is not. It is a matter for the judicial system. You are representing the judicial system. They've been charged with perjury. They've been charged with attempted murder. They've been found guilty. They have yet to be charged. You're on a process. You're not in an investigation. And see, when there's no confidence in the cornerstone of any society, which is equality within the law, then the state's in bother. And the political parties should take good address of it in relation to his so-called investigation.
And I think it's very important, that not least because we're in Derry, that we do touch upon the issues of what happened here all those years ago and the ongoing investigation of the Bloody Sunday. And the political parties, you know, have to face up that issue as well. Some of the parties don't face up to it in any shape or form. All of us have to in terms of investigation and the management of all the legacy issues generally. So is there two more questions before I conclude? So just down here. And there's somebody else back there, whoever he is.
It's your brother? I say the same about you as well, Alex. Councillor Tim Atwood.
I knew it was you.
You touched, the panel members touched on mental health issues, and you know the panel will know, especially in North and West Belfast recently, there's been a number of suicides, and all the agencies, community and clinic, are trying to come together to support all their friends and families in relation to that. But again, in terms of the issue of drugs, and you know the all the evidence in West, and I'm sure it's the same in every other constituency, is the rise in hard drugs, especially heroin, cocaine, and obviously the impact that has on those individuals, their mental health, and crime in the areas. And when we were in West Belfast yesterday, a woman said to me, this is in part of West Belfast, it was Turf Lodge for Catherine. She said, this is not Divis, it's turned into the Bronx. We know there's people selling drugs in the area. How do we get a tackle on that problem? Because it's getting more serious by the week, and it's having a huge impact on the individuals, on the communities, and people are frightened by it. How do we tackle it as part of the criminal justice process, and how do we get the support for those individuals to support them to get off it?
And ask everybody to answer that question quickly, but Tim's quite right. In Turf Lodge yesterday, the sense of despair was tangible, just like in Lower Falls. So, Geraldine, if you want to...
I think the answer in terms of the criminal justice system goes back to problem-solving courts and what we were touching on earlier. I was in Scotland last week, and they run, it's like a problem-solving court around drugs and intervention, and as part of the order that is given out to the offender is around participating in a drug rehabilitation order. Now, the judge in that case takes an active role in understanding the issues that are impacting on that individual's life and putting the support package around that. Now, I know that there's similar models in the Bronx and in other areas of the states where I think that we can
take great learning from. We have to look at what are the broader issues that is leading to the use of drugs, and I think it goes back to Nicola's point as well. It can't just be at the criminal justice side. We need to look at early interventions, and this is a broader social justice issue for all of us, but I think we have to be creative, we need to be innovative, and I think that there's learning out there from places like Glasgow, like New York, which we can take that learning from and introduce here, and I'm certainly really pleased that the Justice Committee are bought into the idea of exploring problem solving courts.
Very, very much so. Alwyn?
I suppose I'd take a slightly different, I'm not disagreeing for a second with what you're saying, but I think there are other elements to the process, and you talk about people's general sense of disengagement and feeling powerless, and I think somehow in Northern Ireland, Mark's right, we haven't done very many things that are all that very imaginative or different here, and sometimes we don't do things all that very well either, and I don't think, and I'm feeding back as somebody who is a member of a PCSP, that I don't think we've got that engagement right. We've sort of set up these structures of politicians, great people, some individuals like me, great people, and some statutory organisations, and that we meet, you know, monthly in relatively quiet places, and we talk about what the problems of the area are. You go out to a public meeting, and in most areas, they are very poorly attended. Engagement isn't really happening. And that is where people in local communities would get answers as to what are the responses, what is happening here locally, what is happening to young people who are involved in whatever they're involved in. And I think we have, quite frankly, poorly performed on policing and community safety as a structure. We've lots of energy, lots of effort, but I don't feel any much of its impact. And certainly the 3 years I did left me disillusioned, disaffected, and I walked away. Yeah. And I don't walk away from much, probably the first time in my professional life. And I just thought, this isn't working, and yet nobody wants to hear there's anything wrong. Everybody signed up for it and thinks it's a grand job. Why would people, that would be a route for people to engage in more local things. Nobody has that opportunity. So it doesn't seem really, in this sense, to have those positive tentacles going out into the community. All we seem to be able to hear about are the negative process of where people are actively involved in intimidating and putting pressure on communities.
Yeah. Like, you're certainly setting the standards for all the parties in the next mandate, because it is my strong sense that it has become lethargic, that the impetus for reform and doing things different has evaporated in some places, and that unless we regather ourselves in that spirit, then we'll just have same old, same old. Nicola?
I mean, I agree with what's already been said. I think it's an issue around hopelessness among young people, and there's an absence of life coping skills. And I think that we do need a creative and a collaborative approach. Mothers in particular are crying out. It's not just Tim, cocaine. Legal highs are terrorising our society and killing off our young people as well. So it's about coming at it from a policing angle. My big concern, because I can see this happening, is when there's a vacuum, you get a vigilante movement out of complete frustration and despair, and that's something that I don't think we need to go to. So we need police cracking down on people who are pushing and selling drugs, the low dealers as well as the big fish in the pond, but we also need a support network around to help our young people, to stop them getting to the point where they're taking drugs, they're self-harming and everything else that comes with that, to block out what's going on in their life.
And the final word then to Will before we conclude this session.
Well, if we're going to tackle it effectively, we need to understand the drugs market, and the drugs market has changed quite substantially over the last number of years. Nicola talked about legal highs, you know, new psychoactive substances. You know, Misuse of Drugs Act 1973 wasn't designed for this.
Yeah.
And we need to understand that we need to keep up in terms of ruined infrastructure. And supply chains have changed. Internet-facilitated drug supply now has completely changed the marketplace, and we're not dealing with the same sorts of drugs in the past. And we have seen an influx of a growing heroin problem based on the influence of Eastern European organised crime gangs. Two very quick points. I think we need to see this as a social and not a criminal justice issue. I fundamentally agree, and we need to start earlier in terms of reducing the demand for those drugs. This is not simple. This is not going to be straightforward. This is a generational issue around drugs. It's not going away completely. We just need to be able to manage it sensibly and effectively. But to do that, we need to understand the problem.
Yeah, somebody, I can't remember where, during the week was talking to me and was saying that the issue of drugs use, a bit like the trauma from the legacy, is now intergenerational.
Yeah.
It's passing from mother to child and so on. So that does suggest the scale of the issue and the scale of the remedy. I have to apologise to the panel because I unilaterally changed the character of this panel because they were all meant to have make a speech, and I decided no, we'll just have questions. And I hope that worked well from this side. Always keep people guessing. Sorry.
We have a question here from an victim of crime, so I think it would be quite useful to hear.
Very quickly.
Now my question